Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
Good morning. It is January 11th in the year 2022. And those were the dulcet tones of our founder and mentor, Brian Brown. Truman, there seems to be some audio problem with that tape. You might want to look at it sometime. It kind of gets gravelly toward the end. But that was Brian Brown welcoming you to the Brown Briefly, a weekly chance to sit down and discuss things local, state, regional, national, and international from the views of the five, today four, Brown Brieflies. So let's start with the check-in and sort of events observed around the island. And let me ask each of you, how did you survive the great freeze and how are you surviving the current atmospheric river, the second that we've been inundated with in the last 3 months? Truman, are you there?
Yes, sir. I'm hiding, I know, but
I know.
my camera's kind of aimed at my left ear this morning, but I'm here.
Well, I want to just check in with you and see what's up.
Well, I tell you, the Sunday we had that beautiful day. Thank goodness I finally was able to get down and get my airplane back. So I have to say our airplane because my partner gives me a bad time when I say my airplane. But, but anyway, yeah, we got her back and it was so nice. And it was in the hangar and I was working on it yesterday and about froze to death because I don't have a heated hangar. But we're surviving, and the runway was actually fairly dry, and got back in one piece. It was nice. Stayed out of the trees, which is always a benefit. So there you go.
Truman is referring to his heroic treetop landing.
Yeah.
What, 3-4 months ago now?
Yeah, no, quite a while. March, May, end of March.
Was it March of last year?
Yeah.
Wow,
yeah.
Almost a year ago. Wow.
Yeah, time flies.
Time flies when you stay alive.
Yeah, it does. It does.
So, Gail, how are you doing? How have you been surviving?
Oh, I'm doing well. Thank you, Bruce, for asking. Yes, it's been a phenomenally wet and wild time with the king tides were very sobering to see the water come up over our boardwalk access in points. And luckily, we did not have any wind behind it, so there was no damage. But still quite a vision to see the way I access my house is down along a boardwalk that runs along the edge of the water. And there's about a dozen or so houses down here that is our only access. So watching that underwater, even for, 45 minutes or an hour was a little chilling. I'm getting still soaking that vision in.
A view of the future, right?
Yeah, and I am, I am aware of that, deeply aware of that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as for the weather, luckily in some ways, we have this big spike in the coronavirus, and at the same time we had this weather, so at least for me, the combination of weather and the coronavirus, the cold freeze kept me all at home. And so that, I'm lucky to have lots of family nearby and friends. So without having to go very far, I mean, lots of soup making at my house and dog walking.
Well, when your house was first built, there was no road there, right? So
yeah, everybody, which is why there is no road there now, right?
Right.
It was one of the houses that was built in the early 20s, and the materials were brought in via the Virginia Five, so down a long boardwalk. The story is that my grandfather carried a brick in each hand every night on his way home from work in Seattle on the Virginia Five. He carried two bricks a day, one in each arm, down the long dock, and then along the boardwalk to build the foundation. So
fantastic. Great story. Great story. Yep. So we may be back to that kind of water access only at some point.
I think so. Luckily, I've got a rowboat. Yes.
Kevin, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, Bruce, and glad to be here. It's been interesting, this snow and then the heavy rains that we've had. When I was driving out my driveway a couple of days ago now, maybe three, I see like a stream running down the driveway. And it's not so unusual when it's raining hard, but this was like after the rain had stopped. And we're on a well, as many are, and there's nine of us here in the community. And so we're always concerned about whether we have a problem with the well and a broken pipe. And as I drive up the road, tracing this stream to its source, up emerging out of the ground is this flow of water. And disturbingly, it's just due north and downstream of the well house. And so we thought, broken pipe looks pretty, you know, pretty obvious. Well, we did a lot of fiddling around, including shutting off the system overnight. And opening it up again, and the spring stopped flowing, but it didn't start again when we opened up the system. So all I can figure is that the water table was so high that it opened up a spring that normally doesn't flow for most of the year. So it's always intriguing to see these natural happenings around us in our environment. So I truly enjoyed that.
Very much so. Yeah. We are creatures of the nature we live in, whether we want to admit it or not. Yes. So tell us a little bit about last Friday and what went on at the main intersection in downtown Vashon.
Ooh, well, you know, we had some hardy souls I didn't count, but around 30 folks showed up to support a vigil for our democracy. And, you know, it's interesting because we know that there's so many laws being passed to restrict voting access under the guise of voter fraud, which we know court case after court case has found little voter fraud. And the ones you hear about are actually from conservative voters voting more than once for the former president. So it's sort of a self-licking ice cream cone, I think, for the conservatives. But the notion that our democracy is fragile, which we hear, I don't think I buy that. I think our democracy is strong and that we have a river of support for democracy that runs really deep in this country. And when we see anti-democratic activities, I think people respond really quickly. Like the QAnon mayor of Squim is not a QAnon mayor of Squim any longer because the community rose up to take action about that. So we just gathered to remind people that January 6th of 2021 was an insurrection designed to attack our democracy and to stop the peaceful transfer of power. And good news is that it failed. The bad news is that folks are still working really hard to overturn and disable the elements of our democracy. And so we need to make sure that we talk about how important that democracy is to us. And we don't want to sing, is it the Joni Mitchell song, "You Don't Know What You've Lost Till It's Gone"? We don't want to sing that song. So let's make sure to stand up for democracy and make sure that it remains as strong as it is and that it serves every one of us to the extent that it can.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Kevin. And we all appreciate what you do with Indivisible Vashon and keeping our eyes on the prize, if you will, of sort of making sure that what we treasure doesn't disappear on us. So, yep. And the Joni Mitchell song is a good reminder. It's too late after it's gone. So let's pay attention. Thank you. What I've been doing at Ellisport and KVI Beach is watching the beach disappear almost every day. It's been incredible. I posted a photograph when we had the extreme high tide, I think on Friday or Saturday, that king tide that Gail was talking about. And literally the KVI Beach was gone. There was the line of logs was all that was visible. Everything else was underwater. And that's only occurred a couple times in the 40 years that I've been here watching the beach. And Gail knows this, and anybody that lives on the water knows that the beaches are dynamic things. They change all the time, you know, and it's sort of one of the joys of living where you can see the beach is watching the waves and the action and the weather move in and out and the tides come and go and how the beach does actually change. It's not a static system by any means. But to see KVI Beach and the sands pit totally underwater is a bit disconcerting. So I posted a photograph on the Vashon Nature Center website. So if you want to take a look and see what the future holds for Gail and I and others, you know, it is a bit disconcerting, you know. So let me talk about Vashon news and see what you guys think about this sort of Omicron spike we're going on. I just looked last night, yesterday, you know, 737,415 new COVID cases, almost all Omicron at this point, and 1,653 deaths in the United States. You know, that's about, what, 747s crashing at a time. You know, it's sort of like, wow, we've become desensitized to that, I think. King County, 4,600 cases yesterday and two deaths. And on Vashon, we're now averaging 13 new cases a day. We've had 38 cases since the 7th of January. So how is this new Omicron spike affecting you? And what do you think lies ahead for the next few weeks, few months for Vashon? Yeah, Kevin?
No, I just, you know, I got a new N95 mask out of the box today, to make sure, you know, that I had it with me in case I did come into close contact with folks in an indoor setting. Mm-hmm. That rate of increase in the spread of infection, while we can have really been thankful that on Vashon we have such a high vaccination rate and such a low incident rate, it also propels us to the idea that we're safer here. And we are safer here, but that doesn't mean we're safe. And so again, you know, those who haven't been vaccinated, this is now a really good time to do that. It's time to think that we need another round of mask wearing and distancing. And it's not clear that this will last long. New York, I understand, is showing some positive signs of the moronic variant now starting to subside. But it is certainly a near-term threat, and we should take it as seriously as possible.
You know, there's I think it was on the news last night? I can't remember now, but they were talking about the how long it takes to become infected wearing the various masks. And with the if you have two people in the room and one is infected and one is not, and they're both wearing masks, how long it takes, you know, for that infection to spread. And the N95 mask, if you're wearing those, that both people are wearing those, it's like 27 hours. I mean, it's a long time for you to become infected. So they're really, really promoting the N95 as the answer rather than, I mean, the cloth mask work, but not as well as the N95. And I want to tell you one other thing. I while waiting to get into Best Buy the other day to get a computer worked on, this fellow came up and he turns out he's an anti-vaxxer and anti-masker and blah, blah, blah. And it was really interesting listening to him because the things that I know several people who are of that particular ilk, and it's really interesting. They all say exactly the same thing. So I'm really wondering where they're hearing where they're getting this script. Because it is exactly the same script. It's, oh, you know, lots of people die all the time. That's nothing unusual. You know, oh, the mask doesn't work. You know, the vaccine doesn't work. But it's absolutely the same words that they use to describe that. I find that very interesting.
Mm-hmm. They're probably getting their script the same place we're getting our script.
Yeah, could be. Yeah, could be.
Just different outlets.
Yeah, that's true.
Social media, TV, whatever.
Right, right.
Cable.
I'm going to say something slightly controversial, but I want to preface it with saying that I absolutely support mask wearing in public, and that I think that I strongly encourage people to become vaccinated.
Excuse me, Gail. You're moving your computer and it's making noise. If you'd please not do that. It really picks up.
It literally is a laptop, so I may have to reposition.
Okay, sorry.
Thanks for letting
me know. Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
I'll try to not add any extra static than besides what I'm going to say, which is
it's going to be pretty staticky. Okay.
You might be pretty glad that it's static while something has occurred to me that I'm curious what the group thinks about this. That we have become so fearful of 2 years now, almost exactly, of worrying and thinking about this virus that we've almost become immobilized. And although, one death is too many, if it's your family member or if it's your friend or loved one, that I think that we might be at a point, at least coming in this spring, where we are going to have to relearn how to relax, relearn how to accept a certain amount of risk in life that we do when we walk on the side of the road or drive a car or ride a bicycle. And that if you're vaccinated and if you're taking regular precautions, I'm wondering at what point do you all think we're going to be able to relax back into something a little closer to what we remember as normal?
Well, I have relaxed a bit. I mean, I still wear a mask if I'm indoors and in public. If I'm here in the studio and everybody's in the studio here happens to be fully vaxxed and boosted, we tend to be a little more relaxed, although the protocols all call for wiping everything down as we always do. But I think personally, I feel like it is relaxing a little. Still being vigilant, still wearing the mask, in crowded spaces. But, I don't know. I'm feeling more relaxed.
Okay.
Kevin.
I was going to say, it's a good question. And, from my background, I think it's a risk management question. And let me say what I mean about that. Humans tend to be willing to accept a certain amount of risk and adjust their behavior on the basis of what they believe the threat is. And so, for example, when I was first driving, you did not have automatic braking systems in your car, ABS brakes. And, when you're driving in the snow, you had to pump the brakes so that you didn't get into a skid. Now you have ABS brakes and the brakes pump themselves, and they do so much more effectively than a human could. What that means is that I can drive a little faster around an icy corner with a car with ABS brakes, right? Because I know that those are going to do a better job than I could of keeping the car on the road. So I adjust my behavior based on my perception of risk. And I think that everybody needs to evaluate their risk situation. So, those who have underlying health conditions who are more vulnerable to the virus, right, need to take that into account. Those who are in a category of folks who are typically not have severe medical symptoms as a consequence of the coronavirus can make adjustments to their behaviors to allow for their personal situation. The only thing that we have to be aware of is that our personal decisions aren't isolated to our own situations with a situation like COVID, right? A respiratory illness. And so we might err a little bit on the side of caution only because of caring for others. But I think that's how it's going to work out in my mind.
One of the great guides is to look to the past. And when you look at the 1918 influenza pandemic, 1918, 1919, it was much like we experienced. Death rates were even higher because the population was smaller, but similar numbers of people died. and worldwide, you know, I mean, millions died. But by 1920, it had become to become a background, sort of it had moved from being a pandemic to being endemic, just being part of the background flu season. It didn't go away. I mean, lots of people think, oh, the 1918 pandemic was over by 1920. Lots of people continued to die into 1920 and 21, but it became an endemic flu. And it still reappears, you know, periodically. There was just an outbreak, what, in flu season 2 or 3 years ago of that strain of the flu. But it becomes that background sort of acceptable risk, if you will, kind of thing. And I see a similar sort of trajectory for this one. I mean, Omicron itself already is less deadly. It's more virulent, but it's less deadly than the previous strains. And I suspect, you know, unless some odd new strain comes out that's really highly deadly, I think we're going to see a similar pattern to 1921-22, where the flu just becomes an endemic background, sort of seasonal kind of flu. The difference, and I hope the difference, is that in 1918 pandemic, by 1922-23, people tried to forget about it. I mean, it just disappeared from the news. What I hope happens with this is that we recognize how vulnerable we are. We've already seen all kinds of things with supply chains and with, you know, hospitalizations, you know, overloads. I mean, all those kind of things. The systems are not built to deal with pandemics, and we need to strengthen our systems, just as we're doing with our highway system, with this Build Back Better, sort of, you know, and the jobs program is to really rebuild the infrastructure. We have a whole healthcare infrastructure that needs serious attention. And so I'm thinking that's, to me, that's the long-term sort of lesson of this, is that we can't become complacent and think, oh, well, this has just become another regular seasonal flu and I get my flu shot and I'll be okay, because this is not the last pandemic we'll see.
I wonder what collectively people felt in the, you know, after the pandemic of the, you know, 1900s in the, you know, the teens there, mm-hmm. 1919, I think was the height of it. Mm-hmm. I wonder collectively what kind of trauma the population experienced. And I wonder what the, you know, when you have large groups of people traumatized by something, how that changes our behavior and our emotional and mental health.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. Nancy Bristow, a historian, lives on Vashon, is chair of the history department at University of Puget Sound, wrote a book on the 1918 pandemic, and essentially the title is The Forgotten Pandemic, because people really tried to forget about it. And one of the things that motivated her to write that book was the fact that her grandfather, who she never met, had died in 1920 as a result of the flu pandemic, but nobody in the family ever talked about it. She did not learn that he died. She knew he died early. She knew he died relatively young, because that pandemic was particularly deadly for those in the 15 to 30 year, 35 year old sort of category. But what's interesting is that her family never talked about it. She never knew about it until she was out of graduate school and was out teaching and was began to research the 1918 pandemic, and then come to find out that her grandfather had died during that pandemic. But nobody talked about it. It was kind of to answer your question, Gail, it was kind of a collective forgetting, mm-hmm. a sort of a major collective effort to just sort of put it in the past and move ahead into the roaring 20s.
Right.
And my question is, are we going to see a revival of the roaring 20s with a sort of like, man, we're out of the pandemic. Let's party, party, party. It's going to be interesting to see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And almost exactly 100 years ago. So very, mm-hmm. very interesting.
Kevin.
Hey, Bruce, I do want to give another shout out on a different topic to local Vashon events. And actually on a near a piece of property that Truman, I believe, owned at one time, the land trust today is out planting cedar trees. just up above 111th in the slope that drops down into Paradise Valley, or the one that rises up from Paradise Valley, you know, to the west. And, you know, we're talking about sea level rise and the beach eroding and Gale's boat and, you know, the notion that tree planting is one of the ways to go forward with carbon sequestration. And I can tell you that the trees I donated that we planted, some of those today, started their life with me in a 12-inch diameter hanging basket in which there were 188 of them. And you've probably heard this story before. I took them all apart, and some of them were like 1 inch tall and the diameter of a pencil. Well, those trees are now about a foot tall, and they're going into the ground to create a new forest on Vashon. So thank you to the Land Trust, Keller, and the volunteers who are out there today, still in the rain, planting trees, I'm sure. There's about 50 or more cedar trees that are going into a new forest on Vashon. So keep up the great work, Land Trust.
Okay. Oh, that's such a great shout out. Thank you, Kevin, for your part in that. And yeah, kudos to the Land Trust for protecting our wild places and the trees that grow on them. And there is no better sequestering mechanism than a tree. So, you know, there no scientific advancement has come up and can do more than a simple tree. And I say simple, but, you know, trees are actually very complicated, amazing organisms, underappreciated occasionally, I
think. So two comments. I have an artist friend here on the island who wants to start a artist against trees because she says the trees block her vision of everything she wants to paint. All she sees are trees. So I have to throw that in, you know, that there is another side to the story. But really, truly, what I was going to say is that on my current, that what you're talking about is I gave a little tiny part of my property to contribute to the trail that you're talking about there. It goes up off of 111th. But on my property, I have a quite a large cedar forest toward the back of the property. And many years ago, I had an arborist come out and that's not really the word. It's a vivi, I can't think of what you call this person. But anyways, a forestry person. I came out and walked my property, and I'm part of the forest stewards. And he said, "Oh, boy, I see you've planted all these cedar trees here." And I said, "Well, no, I haven't planted any of them." He said, "Cedar trees do not self-plant. They have to have disruption in the soil for them to grow." And so you had to have done that. I said, "No, I didn't." And finally we figured it out. My horses, because I have horses back there, they chewed up the soil enough that those trees would self-plant, self-propagate, which I thought was kind of interesting.
Amazing. That's a great story.
Yeah.
There's also another side to think about it is planting trees is a great thing, but also you don't want to plant so many trees that you lose the open spaces in the meadows. And if you talk to Audubon folks and Nature Center folks, I mean, the kinds of birds that were prevalent on Vashon in the middle of the 20th century, when Vashon was like largely agriculture or was moving out of agriculture and still a lot of open fields. And even up into the 1960s and 70s, you know, when I came here, you know, the tree levels were quite a bit lower and there was much more open space. And what that does is it affects those meadow dwelling birds. And so what you've got to do is, I think, like anything, is you've got to find a balance. You don't want to have a whole island forest. You want to have some open swales and some open pastures so that you can have those meadow dwelling birds. But you also want the old growth forests so you can have the birds that need the old growth forests, as well as the sort of transitional fir and alder forest. So it's that balancing sort of effort that needs to take place. And it's always a difficult thing for humans to be able to achieve that balance. So let me move on to the fairy crisis. none of us are commuting much these days. And it's been interesting to watch just demographically how many more people are working from home and how much fewer commuters there are on the island. But at the same time, we are ferry dependent. So how has this ferry crisis of ferries being shut down and Talakaw has been shut down a number of times over the past 2 or 3 weeks? North End's been on a two-boat schedule, and sometimes that's disrupted. How is it affecting us as islanders, and what should we be doing about it?
Well, I think our anger threshold is lower because people get so upset when there's no boat off the South End. I mean, you've got to go clear to the North End and go all the way around if you're trying to go south. So I think the anger threshold has been reduced or lowered with this, and I'm not sure it's going to get any better.
Yeah,
that's right. They've sort of worn us down. Maybe
yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Although Susie said she saw something in the paper last week, and I missed it, about something like, what are we going to do to, your question, Bruce, what are we going to do to ask for better service? I do think that with COVID, you know, there, like you say, a lot less demand on the ferry service. But I can also say that yesterday, Susie and I were caught up in the what we thought was a cancellation of a couple of runs on the South End. It turns out it was just a delay. So, you know, it wasn't a huge disruption to us. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we're you know, shifting appointments to the South End. When we go to Seattle nowadays, you know, we go off the South End and drive up I-5 just because of the uncertainty of how many boats you have to wait on the North End to get a boat, and then the bridge being out, West Seattle Bridge. You know, so none of that's really good because it's, you know, certainly less efficient and more polluting, you know, for us to make that longer drive. You know, I keep thinking that state legislators, that's what they're there for. And, you know, we know that Representative Fitzgibbon and Cody and Wynn, Senator Wynn, are all listening to what we have to say. So now might be a good time to get in touch with them.
Mm-hmm. Gail.
Oh, I was just going to say, I think the one thing I worry about is because we do have limited health care on the island. So even if someone maybe is able to get emergency transportation off of the island via helicopter or holding a boat or something, I think just the fact that so many people do have to go off the island for major medical care is quite an issue to have unreliable ferry service for them. And I... You know, that does concern me, and as well as those who have jobs that they have to commute into, I think it is really quite unfair for them to not have a reliable system for getting to and from work. I mean, many people have children that they're responsible for, or other community responsibilities or responsibilities for members of their family that they're not able to plan or you know, carry out those responsibilities because of that kind of disruption. So I would rather see less ferry service and just keep it consistent if that's what we have to choose.
Right. Yeah, well, it's a problem that's not going to go away immediately, even though there's certainly attempts to deal with the crew problem, the personnel problem, and get more people available. But that takes a while for that pipeline to fill up. Yeah, Kevin.
Yeah, well, of course, we need Captain Joe to step in, you know, get things straightened out. So we know he's working on that. If you don't mind, Bruce, I might try to use this as a segue into maybe what I would say another regulatory issue that is soon to be raise awareness of on Vashon is the move not only in King County to update building codes, mm-hmm. to move us off of fossil gas, you know, what's called natural gas, which isn't natural gas, which is methane, which is a higher global warming potential, things, et cetera, right? A really bad product that hurts our environment and our climate, to move away from that towards heat pumps for water and space heating. And not only King County, but also the state of Washington has some regulatory changes that they're going to be addressing this summer. Or actually in King County, probably this winter. And those who are observant on this issue may have noticed that now two back-to-back ads have run in the Seattle Times disparaging heat pumps. And let me say that I'm in touch with folks who are real experts in this area, and most of what is captured in that advertisement is misinformation. Now, we may all recall a really cold day when Lynn was with us in her jacket in a home that has a heat pump saying it was really cold. It's important to realize a couple things. One is that the heating system you have has to be adequately sized for your home, and your home has to be adequately insulated to protect against heat loss. So with any system, if it's not designed properly for the requirements, then it won't perform as you expect it to. So let's just need to be really careful that it's not that heat pumps aren't the way to go, because I would say that there's many other factors that influence this. But there's some key things in the Seattle Times article that I would like to debunk. One is the claim that heat pumps don't work when it gets cold. And the good news is that new technology makes heat pumps operate and perform well below minus 10 degrees Fahrenheit. Minus 10 degrees Fahrenheit. And so the claim that Eastern Washingtonians will just use resistive heat is not at all true if they're able to have these newer installations, which is what these building codes are talking about. It also says things like, in the summer when they operate as air conditioners, they'll be discharging hot air to the outside. This is true, and it won't be as much hot air discharged to the outside if homes are properly insulated, which these building codes will also help us do. But the idea that somehow we're not going to use the health-saving benefits of cooling us off in a heat dome by not using our air conditioner is sort of faulty logic, in my opinion. And then there's other statements about that you're going to have to upgrade your service panels. That may be true if you have a particularly large house, but heat pumps like I installed, I did not have to upgrade my electrical panel, nor did I have to increase the size of my heat ducts, which is another claim in the article. So there's a fair amount of disinformation floating around. Hopefully people on Vashon will seek out multiple sources of news on this really important change, because buildings are like our number two and most rapidly growing source of carbon pollution. And so this is an important issue for us. And sorry I took so much time to go through it, but I wanted to get some of those points out.
Oh, thanks, Kevin.
A couple of comments. In terms of power use, I have electric heat in my house, so I'm going to actually be able to use a lot less power if I go with the heat pump. That's number one. And many homes do have either baseboard heat or electric furnaces, and those will actually use less power. But the one thing that I haven't seen the article, I just saw what your comments about it. The one thing that has bothered me in electrification of the U.S. and is our grid. The electrical grid. It's a hodgepodge of interconnected, I mean, it's a mess if you really just want to look at it. I mean, the Texas perfectly demonstrated that recently. But so I'm thinking that the infrastructure bill and some of the infrastructure stuff, we really, really need to address a national grid system, or we need to look at localized grids that can function independently. And in fact, I don't know if you've been following, but the Chinese have recently, you've seen this artificial sun that they're talking about. This is fusion, the fusion reaction rather than fission. And it's a type of nuclear energy that we've been looking for. It's the same thing, the same mechanism that fuels the sun. It's the elements are fusing rather than breaking apart. So there's no radiation from it. It's very safe. It's difficult to make. I mean, they've tried to come up with cold fusion for quite a long time, but there it looks like the Chinese maybe have finally gotten a breakthrough, and they're going to start doing that. If they can come up with fusion reactors that are functional, that's going to completely change the whole electrification game. But again, it's, you know, the part of the grid is the big issue. So anyway, I'm just I think we need to be careful on electrifying everything. So
okay. Yeah, I do certainly. The Texas grid is a glaring example of how to not do it right.
Right.
And there's two really important factors that led to the problems they had in Texas. One is that they did not cold proof their power production systems.
Right.
And so even with a grid there, they didn't have power to put on the grid because their natural gas lines froze up, and some of the other problems. I think that they weren't able to de-ice some of the windmills. Those problems don't occur in colder climates because we know well that those have to be done, you know, to make sure the grid is reliable. Also, Texas grid is independent. It's isolated from the rest of the nation. And Texas loves to be this lone star state, right? And don't mess with Texas. But when Texas doesn't choose to join in, like we are here in the Northwest and much of the nation, they suffer those consequences. But I totally agree, Truman, the east and west half of the country, the grids are not joined.
No.
And a lot of analysts say that that would be a huge step forward to help improve the ability for us to distribute electricity. And also with renewable sources of energy, there's a lot of grid improvements and expansion that is going to be required to bring those new energy sources online. And I'm hoping is that the forward thinkers will say, now's the time to not only expand the grid, but improve the grid. So totally agree. The grid is a really important core element, but an achievable outcome as well.
And one of the things that's a simple fix is to run your transmission lines down in the interstate highway system. I mean, we have all these huge right of ways that go, you know, crisscross the country, and there's a perfect utilization there. So.
Or solutionary rail. I understand that Bill Moyer last week was traveling to speak about that concept of using the rail lines for transmission lines.
Right.
And so hopefully some of those innovative ideas can go forward. And another shout out to Backbone Campaign and their innovative thinking about how to use existing infrastructure like rail lines for power systems as well.
Are we going to have a third rail on our railway? I mean, this could be dangerous. You know, no, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly the concept if it's overhead or underground.
Yeah.
But the idea that the rail, that those right-of-ways do exist, and you know that they go through some pretty important parts of the country because there's already infrastructure that tends to want to feed into those rail lines. Which means that they're also in particularly rural America, they tend to be, you know, areas where electricity is used at a higher rate. So you have, you know, you basically bring the electricity close to the point of use, which means you have fewer losses because every mile of line you put power over, you lose a little bit.
Absolutely.
So we're near. Truman's given us the 2-minute signal. We're near the end. Gail, do you have a poem that you could take us out with that would sort of give us some context for what we've been talking about?
That's kind of you to ask. I didn't plan one. Did I miss that on request? My apologies.
No.
My poem, though, that I read last week. The New Year's Wish poem. Mm-hmm. That poem actually will be coming out in the Beachcomber and or possibly the Seattle Times here in the next week. So folks can look for that. And I did see a little thing in the Beachcomber that talking about artists and poets helping us get through this coming year. And I think that is one of our strengths in this community is the artists and poets that help give perspective.
Sure. Well, let me put in a pitch for poetry. And the museum Second Thursday Talks in February 10th, will actually feature Ann Spires and our current poet laureate, Noel What's Noel's last name?
Sandra Noel.
Sandra Noel, right, yeah. So, sorry, but we're going to have a talk about the place of poetry in a small community and a little bit about the history of the poetry pole. And so, you know, the museum is certainly aware of the power of poetry, and it'll be a fascinating talk February 10th. Yeah, Kevin.
And I just want to say again, on January 19th, a mere 8 days from now, you can hear more of Bruce Hallman's views on democracy as he joins Indivisible Vashon at our member meeting. Go to indivisiblevashon.org and go to the page that has the next meeting and register to hear Bruce and I talk more about the environment and more about our democracy.
Okay, guys. See you all next week.
Thank you.